WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
At the National Conference of Mayors later this month, mayors will discuss the feasibility of filing lawsuits against the gun industry similar to those already filed by Chicago and New Orleans. My guest, Tom Diaz, supports these suits. He's the policy analyst for the Violence Policy Center, a think tank working to reduce gun violence. Diaz is also the author of the new book, Making a Killing, about how guns are marketed and sold in the U.S. Do you think that these city suits against the gun industry are going to have a big impact, or do you see them as just another step along the way, and next year there'll be another trend, and there'll be some kind of cumulative effect perhaps, but the major effect isn't going to be these particular suits?
No, I think the suits will have both a cumulative and a major effect. I am not a person who believes that necessarily that any of the existing lawsuits will be smashingly successful and that will bring the gun industry to its knees. But I do believe that they reflect a different way of thinking about firearms litigation, and I think they're the beginning stages, if you will, of a longer process. One of the problems may be that the gun industry itself may not realize that it is now in a different ball game than it's been used to, where it has controlled the playing field and been really the better financed, if you will, the better lawyered, the better litigated team. I think that's changing.
How is it changing?
It's changing in a couple of ways. One is that through the efforts of organizations like ours and others, people are starting to learn more about how the gun industry actually works. We're not just looking at firearms and at a point that was made earlier that, well, all guns are lethal, so a gun is a gun, and these are bad, and we should sue and stop them. That doesn't get very far, and that's the approach that's been tried in the past. But when one looks at the actual things that the gun industry does or that it does not do to lessen the impact of this inherently and demonstrably lethal product, then we're beginning to find out some very interesting things. And I think those things are opening up avenues of theory making by lawyers and litigation. And then, of course, we have the element that we have the model of the tobacco litigation. And quite frankly, as has always been the case under our system of torts, lawyers are beginning to get interested in this, and they will push the envelope and the margins, and the gun industry will find itself constantly facing new theories, new ideas, new research.
What are the new things that you think we're likely to learn from these suits?
One of the processes that goes on in any lawsuit is a discovery process. And we're going to find out what thought does the industry actually give to, for example, the questions I raise in my book about lethality of firearms. What thought does it give to selling guns to dealers beyond the requirements that they have a federal license? The gun industry likes to say it's heavily regulated because everybody has to have a license. But there are several well-documented cases of people with licenses selling firearms routinely to gangs in not just hundreds but thousands during the year. The question is, in the distribution process, what care does the industry give to ensure that that doesn't happen? Now, I understand very well that the industry says today that's not our responsibility. We follow every federal regulation faithfully. But in tort litigation, that's not the end of the question. The question is, did you as an industry have a duty to be more careful? Did you have a duty to inquire into the ends of the use of your product? Those are the open questions. We certainly have a point of view about how we think they ought to come out, but those are the kinds of questions that the industry will be repeatedly asked in years to come.
Now, the Chicago lawsuit charges that the gun industry is oversupplying the legitimate market, and they're therefore creating a pool of weapons that could be sold in the black market. Now, you write that although the purchase of new guns is regulated and the buyer is subjected to a waiting period while his background is checked, regulated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the nation drops its guard once a new gun has been sold for the first time at a retail outlet. Where are guns sold after that, and is that regulated in any way?
For all intents and purposes, it is not regulated except at sometimes at the state and local level. And even there, people will, in law enforcement, for example, will concede in most states that even if there are laws, they're very difficult to enforce. But essentially, firearms, once they leave the initial retail sale, the licensed dealer, are sold in almost any manner you can imagine, just as you might sell a used car or a piece of furniture. That is, they're sold in flea markets or things that are called gun shows where people come in big numbers to buy guns. They're sold across backyards. So as broad as the imagination of people is to sell things, that's how guns are sold. And actually about 40% of the firearms acquired every year or transferred every year in the United States are sold through these secondary or informal markets.
The New Orleans lawsuit against the gun industry contends that gun makers failed to include enough safety devices in their weapons, and that makes their guns unnecessarily dangerous. The gun industry is not regulated by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. What kind of regulations would your group, the Violence Policy Center, like to see governing the safety of guns?
Well, without going into too much detail about the specific regulations, we would like to see firearms regulated in the same manner that every other consumer product in the United States is. Firearms are really the last holdout for regulation. So that means that there would be a regulatory body, and we favor the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms because of their existing expertise. But they would look at firearms and determine whether the design of the firearm from a point of view of public health and safety really was satisfactory, and if not, that agency would be able to say either you could not produce this firearm or you would have to take whatever the appropriate steps were, much in the same manner that when toys or mattresses or bicycles or off-road vehicles are made in such a way that a reasonable person looking at the design and the intended use can say this is going to cause a problem, then we wouldn't probably allow, certainly we would not allow semi-automatic assault weapons to be manufactured and sold. And we believe that ultimately handguns would be phased out through such an agency.
What's confusing here is that, you know, mattresses and pajamas and toys and things like that are in no way designed to hurt anybody, whereas guns are designed in part to kill, not necessarily designed to kill another person, perhaps designed to hunt. But it's no big shock if a gun kills somebody. I mean, they're lethal weapons. They're deadly weapons. So does that change the nature of the regulation of the safety of guns or safety devices on guns, or, you know, how a gun is regulated compared to how combustible pajamas would be regulated?
Yes, every gun that is manufactured is by definition a lethal instrument. But there are different things that can be done in the manufacture, or there are different design packages, as in the case of semi-automatic assault weapons, which are really a package of accoutrements, if you will, that make that gun most useful for mass shootings of people. There are things like the capacity of magazines. Magazines are often called clips in lay language. They are the ammunition feeding devices. When you have a magazine that can hold 15, 20, 100, even 120 rounds of ammunition, that serves almost no, and I would say no useful purpose other than to provide the shooter with an unlimited, for all intents and purposes, package of ammunition to kill people. We've seen that in numerous atrocities, such as the Long Island Railroad Massacre. And in the case of handguns, we see designs on the market today of very small, very compact guns that can be hidden easily, not only on the person, but literally in the palm of one's hand, in very high calibers, meaning large bullets propelled with great force. These are all variables that the gun industry could have voluntarily restricted, chose not to do, but in fact chose to emphasize in order to rejuvenate markets, but that a responsible product and health safety agency would probably say, we've got to go back to the drawing board with these things.
Now, another problem that you have cited in your book is that there are a lot of guns in the United States that have actually come from other countries, some legally, some illegally. And you suggest that this is the reverse of how the American Tobacco Company sells a lot of cigarettes to third world countries, countries where there's less education about the harmful effects of cigarettes. How do you see the import of guns in America being comparable to the export of tobacco?
Well, I think of the United States really as sort of the third world of the gun culture. Gun companies in countries like Brazil and our neighbor to the north, Canada, can manufacture firearms and ship them to the United States that they cannot, by their own laws, sell in their countries. I'm a big fan of legislation that would say you could not import into the United States any firearm that could not be sold in the country from which it's exported in the ordinary civilian market, and that would cut a great deal of the gun imports out of this country. And yes, it's true, about a third of the handguns, for example, marketed in the United States come from abroad. Most people I talk to have the impression that the United States is an exporter of civilian firearms and that we're responsible for civilian firearm violence in the world, when it's really quite the contrary.
You say that the gun industry is concerned about future sales. First of all, they're afraid that guns don't wear out the way, say, automobiles do. And you could use a gun for a really long time. You don't have to replace it with a newer model just to get something that functions. And that the gun industry is also concerned that it has to have some kind of incentive for people to keep upgrading their guns, to buy new models. What do you see as being some of the ways the gun industry is trying to expand sales?
There are a number of things, and it's not that the gun industry is afraid. They know this for a fact, that their markets are flat for all the reasons you articulate. In the past, here are some of the things that the gun industry has done and that I document in my book. The whole phenomenon of semi-automatic assault weapons in the 1980s was a function of gun industry marketing. The appearance of high-capacity semi-automatic pistols, the so-called Wonder Nines, were a function of gun industry marketing, and that's being continued to play out in the manufacture of these much smaller guns I was talking about in higher calibers. I'm doing some work right now that to me is just about as cynical and crass an example of gun industry marketing as I've seen, and that is the marketing to civilians of sniper rifles. These are not hunting rifles with telescopes or shooting scopes mounted on them. These are rifles that were designed principally for military and police application and are now being presented to the civilian market. It's something that I first noticed when I was researching the book, and I didn't have a lot of time to look into it, and I'm doing it now, and it's about as cold an example of selling something just to keep the market going as I've seen. Finally, the industry is looking to new populations. They're looking to market to women in particular for a couple of reasons. One, in our society with single parent households, the single parent most often is a mother, and they see that as having two benefits. One, if they can get the mother interested in firearms, that's good, but she's going to have an influence over the children, and they know from all sorts of studies that the earlier a person is introduced to firearms, the more likely that they're going to continue.
In 1994, the Justice Department published a survey that said that, quote, one of the best predictors of gun ownership was the presence of firearms in the respondent's childhood home. In other words, if you grew up in a home with guns, you're more likely to be a gun owner when you become an adult. Now, you suggest that the gun industry agrees with that Justice Department survey and that they're working really hard to try to encourage parents to include their children in gun-related activities.
That's true. The gun industry does believe that that's true. They say that in their strategic meetings. They know that hunting as a sport for a variety of reasons is diminishing. And they know that since we no longer have a uniform draft, that young men are not introduced to firearms through the military. So they openly strategize, and by openly I mean within their own publications, which I read a lot of, about the need to bring children into the shooting sports through their family activities. That's not a secret. That's a very open thing the gun industry talks about.
My guest is Tom Diaz of the Violence Policy Center. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Diaz. He's a senior policy analyst with the Violence Policy Center, and he's author of the new book, Making a Killing, The Business of Guns in America. although you are now pretty strongly anti-gun, you used to be an NRA member. Your father was a career Army officer. You learned to shoot in the Boy Scouts as a teenager in Mississippi. You were on a rifle team in high school. You handled guns during the service with the Air Force Reserve and the National Guard. You competed in a pistol league. You've owned handguns and shotguns. What made you change your mind about guns?
I think I've thought a lot about this, and I think the single point that I can put my finger on that really changed the way I thought about guns was my service on the House Crime Subcommittee, when the person who did the gun account, as they say, left, and because I knew something about guns, I was then the counsel who took over the gun account. And one of my first responsibilities was organizing a hearing about the impact of firearms on children. In fact, we call that hearing Kids and Guns. And when I began to hear firsthand from interviewing these children before the hearing and then actually see them in the hearing, the impact that these guns were having in their lives, it impressed me how very different that was from the kind of rhetoric that one learns and repeats when one is in the firearm culture. And I also, through the process of these hearings, began to see that the guns that are on the streets of America today are markedly different from the guns that were on the streets 25, 30 years ago. Semi-automatic assault weapons, high-capacity pistols, and now we're starting to see sniper rifles. These kinds of things are not like the golden era of the 1950s or what have you. And even in the shooting sports, when I shot, I shot on what's called a standard pistol course, where we shot at the familiar bullseye paper target. Now we see an enormous amount of aggressive and, in some cases, I think almost wishful gunplay, where there are scenarios called combat shooting that really are only designed to simulate circumstances in which a person is involved in a shootout, if you will, with another person. And that concerns me about our culture generally, and specifically about the gun culture.
You said that you started to compare the rhetoric of the gun industry with what you were seeing consulting to the House Crime Committee. Would you make that comparison for us?
One of the things that not only the industry, but I think people, I like to use the term the gun culture generally, which includes the industry and consumers and the National Rifle Association, believe in very strongly is, of course, the Second Amendment. And they believe in a specific interpretation of the Second Amendment, which is that it provides an unlimited personal right to the ownership and possession of almost any imaginable form of firearm. And that is tied into the belief that this is an essential part of keeping our country free. When a person gets wrapped around that culture, it becomes almost a self-fulfilling thing, that you see any form of regulation, however modest, as really part of an ultimate plot to take away freedoms. On the other hand, one can look at it in an entirely different way, which I came to look at, which is that there is almost no freedom in this country that is absolute. And I do not believe that the Second Amendment is absolute. Certainly no federal court has ever ruled that. And that there's a balance that one has to strike. The NRA likes to say, guns don't kill people, people kill people. I believe that there's a shared responsibility. The proliferation, the availability of firearms and of specific types of firearms, combined with bad things about human nature, which I don't deny, kill people, and they do it on a scale in the United States that's unprecedented anywhere else in the world. So I think it's the ability to be a little bit balanced about this, the ability to see that there are things about guns themselves that we could do something about, and just plain caring for other human beings.
What do you think the minimal gun ownership rights should be?
I think one should have the right to own firearms that do not inflict unreasonable likelihood of harm or injury to others as a generic thing. That sounds like a lot of lawyerly double talk. I'll try to make it more precise. I have no problem with ordinary hunting firearms. I don't even have a problem with shotguns, and I don't have a problem with shotguns as a form of home defense. In fact, it's probably one of the most reasonable ways to go. I'm not for banning firearms or putting the industry out of business. But I do think that certain classes of guns, if you will, are just demonstrably, the risk of those guns is demonstrably beyond any conceivable benefit. So I'm a sort of modified Second Amendment person, I guess. I don't believe it's an absolute right. I believe the state can heavily regulate firearms if it chooses to do so, but I'm not in favor of banning all classes of guns.
Tom Diaz is senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center and author of the new book, Making a Killing, The Business of Guns in America.